Thank you for joining me today for Wealth, Health, and Other Things You Should Know. My name is Brian Beutel. I'm a Senior Vice President and Certified Private Wealth Advisor, Certified Exit Planning Advisor, and Certified Trust and Fiduciary Advisor with UBS Wealth Management in Boca Raton, Florida, who, along with my son Cameron and our team, are dedicated to our relentless pursuit of knowledge and to do our best to address our clients' most formidable financial needs. I hope you may find in each and every podcast an opportunity to gain new insight and perspective on many of the most relevant issues of our time. So let's get going. Hi, and welcome to another edition of Health, Wealth, and Other Things You Should Know. My name is Brian Beutel. I'm here today with my guest, Sean Hutchinson. Sean is a partner in RFN Global, which is an advisory group primarily assisting business owners, advisors, with the primary emphasis to try and assist business owners in the process of selling their business or, more importantly, increasing the value of their business. Sean has been in business for over 30 years. He's founded more than half a dozen companies, all of them with partners, some more successful than others. As one of the founders of RFN Advisory, Sean's primary focus, like I said, is strategy and growth, trying to help owners imagine what being a company of the future really looks like for them and help them achieve it, more importantly. And Sean sees his work as transformational, not just transactional. And we'll touch on that in a little bit. Sean, obviously well-educated individual, as you can imagine, master's degree from Miami University in Ohio. He's a certified exit planning advisor and a certified merger and acquisition advisor. So Sean, welcome. Appreciate you spending a little bit of time with us today, which I think is a very, very important topic. Obviously, you're heavily involved in the issues relating to business, the business world, business transition, both obviously business sales, maybe intergenerational, which is a big issue as well, from family member to family member, and or really just increasing the value of a business, especially kind of in today's tough times with COVID and all of the struggles that are out there. So with that being said, we back a few months ago kind of did a very brief introductory podcast in relationship to being a certified exit planning advisor and what that entailed. But give us a little background on your company and what specifically you do, if you might.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Brian, for having me. I really appreciate it. It's our pleasure. So Ready for Next, which is what RFN stands for, Ready for Next Advisory Group is a consulting group that works with owners and their management teams and really throughout their entire enterprises to help them increase the enterprise value of their company and also increase its transferability. And by transferability, we mean the ability to transfer it to another owner at some point in the future. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be a sale to a third party. As you pointed out earlier, it could be an intergenerational transfer in a family business if that's something that they want to do. But it could also involve a management buyout, a sale to the employees, transfer to another partner, or all or some of those things along sort of the spectrum, the journey to an owner's full transition out of their business. So we're really interested in, for instance, taking clients that might have a business worth $20 million, working with them over, say, a 3 to 5 year period through some very structured value acceleration, transition planning, transition readiness programs that we have, and helping them build a $40 million enterprise business that in fact can be monetized, that can be harvested on terms that are comfortable for the owner. That's a little bit difficult to say, it'll always be on your most favorable terms and you'll get to do it exactly when you want to get to do it. But what we emphasize is be ready for transition, not necessarily just thinking about transition as a point in time, something that you kind of pick out there on the horizon and go do it. It's more about creating full transition readiness within the company. And that takes a lot of personal planning also for the owner or the owners and their families, which is really the practice that you're in, Brian, is helping them understand the tie between two of these things, which is managing their biggest asset in the case of a business. It is almost always their biggest financial asset.
So true. So true. And I think it's kind of a point of confusion. I've had various business owners mention to me, you're not an investment banker, you don't sell businesses. So, I think specifically when you talk about increasing the value or accelerating the value of a private business, you know, can you give our listeners a couple specific items that is the area of value creation?
Yeah, great question. This can be a complex area, so maybe it's useful to talk about some value killers and value drivers just to kind of locate some very concrete things on a map that we might refer to as the value acceleration universe, because there's a lot that goes into it potentially. You're right. Let me emphasize that we are not investment bankers. We're not business brokers. We don't do law. We don't do accounting. We're not financial managers. All those things. We are purely value accelerators, what we might be referred to as a value growth advisor sometimes. But of course, we're working in holistic teams with folks like you, because these, you know, personal and business items should never be separated from one another. Absolutely has to be holistic. And that's a piece of what we're looking for in the process, is that holistic plan. We contribute the value optimization to it, but the personal planning and the life after business planning has to be done in a team. And until all those things are kind of wrapped up nicely in a package, I don't think that we have a plan that can be executed in a way that gives the owner their ultimate, their real outcome, right? The outcome that they want to see. Now, to value drivers and value killers, I recently wrote a couple of blog posts. I'm a fellow for the University of San Francisco's Gellert Family Business Center. I wrote a blog post there on their website now called The Top Three Value Drivers. And I also wrote one on the top three value killers. So let's talk about that for a minute, because I think it gives us, again, some context. So the top three value drivers, as an example of what we would look at. So a recurring revenue model is going to drive a lot of value. Now, there are six different forms of recurring revenue, which we will not go into here. But I just want to encourage owners to think about, if you can drive more consistency in your revenue model, if you can take some volatility out of the business model, out of the revenue model, you are going to have a far more valuable business, because somebody looking at it through the eyes of an investor, which is something that we always encourage our clients to do. Step outside the business, turn around, look at it through the eyes of an investor, because in fact, as an owner, that's what you are. You are making investments daily in your business, right? You could take that money out, put it in your pocket. You're rolling it back into business. You're making an investment. Look at your business through the eyes of an investor. How would that third party independently scrutinize it? So if they're looking at a revenue model that's up and down and up and down, has no predictability, you can't really say what the customer is going to be from month to month, quarter to quarter, then it's going to create risk for them. And risk drives value down, right? So one of the things that we're looking for when we're doing value creation is how much risk can we identify, mitigate, or eliminate, and then manage going forward. Risk has a way of seeping back into companies. It can be quite insidious. So you have to have a system in place for managing it. So we're looking for all those things: recurring revenue, strong business model, risk management. That makes a difference. Second value killer, top value driver, is really owner independence. Can the business run without the owner? And we have a 10-point scorecard on that one. It's not as simple as the sort of metaphor that we always use, if you will. The context is, can you take a 2-week vacation and not really worry about your business? And that's kind of a good indicator. But there are a lot of other indicators, like you spend most of your time on strategy, not operations, like operational decisions are made without you weighing in on it, and everybody's okay with that, like your biggest customers are comfortable checking in with your operational team rather than you. So that owner independence is really important. And then the third value driver that's super important is commanding a niche in a growing market. So we're looking for companies, and if the company doesn't have it right away, we're helping them work on strategies that can create a niche for them or allow them to exploit a niche that they may not have had visibility on before, but in a growing market, right? You don't be a printing company looking for a niche. You could probably find a niche in printing, but it's not a growing market. So you're always going to be that headwind. And, you know, Steve Jobs called niches white spaces, places where competitors weren't, or it was very light, and you could get in there and you could pry it open and you could absolutely dominate it. That's one of the ways that Apple became, you know, a really valuable company. Now, if we turn it around on the value killer side, so those are three good examples of things we might work on to drive value. On the value killer side, concentration, what we mean by that usually is customer concentration. Do you have one customer that's more than 10, 15, 20% of your top line revenue? But you could also look at it as profit concentration. Do you have one customer that represents a large part of your profit at a higher margin where everybody else or that customer, double whammy, is they're a big customer for you at a lower margin. That's where you really start to get into trouble. You could also have product concentration, industry concentration, geographic concentration. That whole group of things needs to be looked at. Lack of succession planning. Now we're right in that exit planning advisor world, right? Where we're working on stability within the industry. Again, succession planning is a way of avoiding or mitigating against disruptions in the model, in the operations, in the marketplace. Once you command a place, you don't want to lose your advantage because you didn't do planning around what happens if key employees leave. Our succession systems, training, knowledge base in place, looking for all of that. And then the third value killer that I never really think this is a hard one to solve, but it can be. And that's poor financial systems, reporting, and management. Those companies that really can manage their finances and know their financial metrics and how they drive operations and how they relate to strategy, those are really good businesses. But more often than not, I would say, we find that businesses are kind of under-resourced in that area. The accounting department may be too small, or they're not really tracking financial metrics on a scoreboard, or their software is really not adequate. They kind of outgrew it 5 years ago, but they never really wanted to go the pain of transferring over to a new system. And their business is just too big for that particular software. So they're struggling to get what they need out of it. So those are some value drivers and killers. That's the kind of stuff we're going to look for and work on when we work with our clients.
The last one you wouldn't think, like you said, you would just kind of make an assumption that a business has a good handle on that. And you're saying, in your experience, that's not been the case. So I think, like most business owners, we all want to feel we're indispensable. But is there more often than not a trigger that comes up that it moves from 24/7, a business owner concentrating on their business, to an event that kind of moves them in that direction? And I mean, hopefully it's not an illness or something along those lines. I find even something recently, it's the call out of the blue. Hey, I want to buy your business. Sometimes it's a competitor. But what is your experience? Is there, you know, more of a trigger in that or not?
Yeah, so I think the big trigger, and to a certain extent, a good advisor can work with an owner to kind of explore these things. The trigger is self-awareness. So when the owner gets to that point where they might think, wow, I'm really tired. And when they look at the situation, they're like, well, I'm working too much. I'm way out of whack on work-life balance. You know, there are family considerations. I don't feel like I'm around for my kids or whatever it might be. So those kinds of things make a difference. Those are big issues if you can uncover them. But if the owner becomes self-aware, one, that that's happening, or more to the point that their business may have moved beyond their ability to manage it and grow it. So if they are self-aware, they might at some point say, you know what, I've taken this as far as I can or as far as I really need to. The business is big enough that we can hire a good professional management team. And I can become a more strategic figure or relationship management figure within the organization. But that awareness is rare unless somebody starts to develop it, maybe through a coaching program or something like that. But the second thing is, you know, they have to kind of get used to the fact that they won't be the CEO, right? They won't have that daily decision-making. That takes some getting used to. It can be really emotional. It's kind of like the emotion that an owner experiences when they do sell their business and they have that, they may have an identity crisis around that. Same thing can happen internally if you go to professional management. Now, interestingly, Dennis Jaffe is a really good family business consultant. He's a former professor. He's written a lot of books. He did a study on 100-year family enterprises, and he found of the businesses that he studied, all these enterprises, which were, you know, anywhere between 100 million and maybe many billions of big family enterprises in some cases, complex. He found that every single one of those, when they were smaller, everybody starts small, right? So when they were smaller, by the second generation, in every case, they had brought in outside professional management to replace the family members, and they had established governance, meaning that they had a board of directors with outside independent directors on it, not just family members, not just insiders, not just friends, but real independent directors who had fiduciary responsibility and input into the business. I found that fascinating. And what it said to me was, once the owner becomes maybe aware and receptive to outside perspectives, less insular, they are much more likely to step back and say, let's bring in the folks that are right for this time, right? That's the key, is just because you started the business, you might not be the person to see it through its next cycle, through its next phase. And so you have to be sometimes brutally honest about that. And it's hard.
Not so easy sometimes for, I think you get, you know, especially interfamily, you get the whole emotional dynamic. That's, I think you said it earlier, to be able to become self-aware, to get to that point sometimes is a little bit difficult. But where does it all start? Okay, so you get a business owner, they start to think about things, part of the massive baby boom generation business owners. What's the starting point to start exploring it and to look at it, you know, beyond the accountant and let's say the attorney, to look at that beginning step?
So I always say to any business owner, if they're having trouble getting started, let's prioritize one thing. Let's do one thing, whatever that might be. And it could be related to, but not exactly, value acceleration. It could be, hey, you don't have an up-to-date, comprehensive, or really good, solid financial plan in your hand, ready to go. So let's go get that so that we can get a sense of your total asset base. So that's when we're going to somebody like you, Brian, and we're saying, let's get a financial plan in place as a first step. It also gives us a lot of visibility into what's going on. It's important information for us as value growth advisors. However, if you're stepping into the value growth process, the first thing we're going to do is discovery. Discovery for us has a couple of different pieces to it, actually four potential pieces. But the first thing we're going to do is actually come in and interview key people in the company as a group, not individually typically, but as a group. And we're going to explore what we call seven value domains, right? So we're going to explore things like culture and leadership. We're going to explore risk and strategy and financial management and sales and marketing. And we're going to look at all of those in the story of the business, within the context of the story of the business. Now, we can't tell that story. It's not up to us to got to sort of structure that conversation in a way that we make it solely about us. It's our responsibility to facilitate getting the story from a lot of different perspectives. It's interesting to me. Often we'll find that people who work really closely together have not voiced a particular perspective that they have, which may be totally different than the person who sits right down the hall, so to speak, from them. They see the company in two different ways, or they see an aspect of the company in two very different ways. That's not to say that there's a conflict. It just means there's different perspectives. And both of those perspectives are important. Those folks may not be owners. The owner may have a totally different perspective. Why? Because they're an owner. Because they see the company in a different way. It's their money that they're putting into it, right? It's their risk that they're taking financially every day. So they see it through an owner lens. A manager sees it through a manager lens. How do you bring all that out in a story and then put it together in something that says, here's a map. Here's something that we can start from. We can also do an operational assessment, which is really more about looking at the meat and potatoes of the business. How does it operate, right? What are the strengths of its processes and documentations and IT and things like that? Those two things combine really interesting. Once we get that baseline, and out of that, we may in fact get a baseline value for the business. We don't do valuation. We might bring somebody in to do it. But getting a baseline value is really important because we need to know where we're starting. And we need the owner to agree with it, to understand it, to basically say, all right, I will accept that as a starting point, or this range as a starting point. At least we know where we are. And I think that value baseline is really, really important, because otherwise, how do we know we're making progress, right? We can check in on that from time to time. You want to see 10 million go to 15 or 20. It's motivating, but it's also part of the work. It's what we're there to do.
And you can quantify as you move forward the impact on that business value, I would assume. But I think your point earlier, it's very true. In a lot of businesses, it's the input of the owner, but not maybe some of the key employees, the people who maybe at a more granular level are dealing with customers more, are seeing something. Sometimes the owner gets into kind of a narrow mode. Their input is extremely valuable.
Well, and you know, it's interesting. So, you know, you might be a person working in operations who doesn't know anything about the finances of the company because it's not transparent, because somebody didn't share it. I don't know how you can run an operations, be the COO, for instance, or director of operations, if you don't really understand what the impact of operational decisions is on finances, and vice versa. What are the impacts of financial decisions on operations? That ecosystem doesn't always tie together as tightly as we would like to see it. So information flow, knowledge flow within the organization, if it gets sort of puddled up, if it gets constricted, then the value of the information is actually diminished by the minute that it's kind of sitting in that puddle. But if you see a business as, I mean, there's a reason that they're called corporations. It's about the corporal body. That's where the word comes from. So if you look at it as a body and it has, you know, blood vessels and muscles and all these things kind of, I always say that the thing that's in the blood of the business coursing through those veins is culture. That's what makes it happen, right? That's what feeds the whole thing. But information and data, the information and knowledge within the organization is culture. The decision-making is culture, not just, so culture has become, I think, an overused word in some ways within business. Everybody likes to talk about it. Nobody can quite figure out what it is. But I think if you think about all of that kind of coursing through the body of the business and informing it, we want to talk with our clients about creating a culture of value creation. So that would mean ideally that everybody in the company, as they go about their business, is thinking like an owner to the extent that they can. What would they do if they were an owner? What does that decision mean from an ownership perspective? But also understanding that their decisions, every decision that they make ought to be a value building decision, not a value killing decision. Getting, you know, close to what is one and not the other is work. You have to understand it within the context of the market and the business itself. But if we could get everybody on the same page about that, imagine what would happen within a business if you could walk in and everybody in the business is creating value on a daily basis, or at least doing their best to make that happen. That's a very, very valuable company in and of itself. And you can feel that when you walk into a client. You can feel it when you walk into their building.
I've always felt that the culture of a business or an organization is critically important to success. And I think that, you know, that kind of, in a lot of cases, gets lost in the shuffle. We're sitting here, and hopefully in the next few months, it's been awful tough for business owners with COVID and trying to move into more of a virtual business. Very difficult times, but there's a whole nother sleeve of the world that's changing, and that's environmental, social governance, critically important. It's going to require businesses, again, to change dynamically to address those issues. And, you know, both what's known as ESG, environmental and social governance. Can you touch on that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of, I think there's a growing movement toward it. And I think I'll put it within the context of family businesses, because family businesses typically are driven by personal values, family values a lot of the time. And those core values may or may not be connected to the environmental, social governance, of sustainability kind of way of doing business. But also this, you know, I think a lot of people think that ESG initiatives are kind of the domain of very large publicly held companies that are going to leverage that, right? It's not the case. I mean, the mid-market companies are definitely focusing on this. Now, PwC just put out a really interesting report. This is their 10th annual family business survey that they've done. And this time it was called From Trust to Impact, right? And it was really about, it was a good barometer, I think, of just a measure of where family businesses are today as we kind of start to move out of COVID, what's actually happening. There were some interesting statistics, I thought. One, according to the Edelman Trust Barometer, which Edelman is the big global communications firm, and they do this barometer every year on trust, 67% of respondents being consumers trusted family business, compared to 58% trusting publicly traded companies. So there is a higher level of trust between the family business and its customer. Only 21% of family businesses in 2020 during COVID had to go out and raise additional capital. This was the heaviest capital raise year in a very long time, more than $3.6 trillion raised from private equity. But family businesses didn't have to do it, which means that they're generally more resilient. And part of that, I think, is that they are, in fact, family businesses. It gives them a good foundation for kind of getting through tough times. The survey looked at 2,800 family businesses around the world in what they call 85 territories. And the businesses that they surveyed, 55% of them said there's an opportunity for them to lead the way on ESG initiatives, right? So they're absolutely tuned into, hey, we can really make an impact here. in sustainable business practices, but only 37% of those have a strategy around how to do that, right? So at the same time, 43% of consumers are willing to punish a company if it does not have ESG initiatives and practices that are obvious to it. So it also falls down their list of priorities, where her top priorities were really about the digital management. Social responsibility, carbon footprint reduction, and local community investments fell in the bottom tier of their priorities. So there are sort of some disconnects here. There's a desire for social sustainability governance initiatives. Everybody knows that that's important. But here's what I'm seeing. I think this is really going to ramp up as we go from this generation of owners to the next generation of owners. I think we all know that the next generation, whether they're business people or not, care deeply about environmental impact, sustainability, social responsibility, those kinds of things. And they are going to make it absolutely a core piece of their business model and a core piece of their identity. And in fact, I think they'll win as a result of that. I think that's going to position them extremely well, but they have to align corporate values with family and personal values. And they struggle to do that. They're still on the learning curve to make that happen. But, you know, God bless them for making the effort, because it's super important. Family businesses across the globe produce half the GDP in the world and employ 2/3 of the employees globally. That's all family business. So they have an enormous opportunity to make a really big impact. And I think it's something that the successor generation is already pressing the predecessor generation to think about and do, to act on it, not just think about it, to act on it. Not to say that it isn't going to take some time to accomplish that, but the awareness is there.
Agreed. I think, and again, kind of summarize a little bit, and what you do and your company does, is that it's really a process that should start prior to entertaining an offer or a business sale. So those metrics are quantifiable in terms of increasing the value in a private business. So how would somebody get in contact with you or your organization to start this process?
Yeah, so probably through the website. So there are a couple of ways to do it. So go to readyfornext.com. That's our global website. Or you can go to readyfornextadvisorygroup.com for the advisory services. You can reach out through there. You can connect with me on LinkedIn. Sean P. as in Patrick, Sean P. Hutchinson. Please, I invite you to connect with me. That would be great. I always like to hear from people. And on the RFN Academy, we have a lot of resources for business owners that you may find useful. rfnacademy.com, that's our online platform. So any way that you can reach out, we are going to respond immediately. And we encourage you as an owner to start exploring these issues, because Brian, I think you're right. Typically, you know, you need to get at least a 3, probably closer to a 5-year head start on this stuff, because not only personal planning, tax and estate planning, like, you know, the things that UBS does so well, but the business aspects of these things don't change overnight. I mean, you really got to not just act on them, but then let them kind of seep into the organization and kind of live there for a while and, you know, stew in a sense so that they take hold. And somebody coming in from the outside, I mean, you can sort of talk pretty about what you've done, but unless they can see it in the daily practice, daily life and culture of the organization, it might look pretty thin to them, kind of like a veneer, and that's not going to work. So yeah, a head start is a good idea. Now, a lot of owners are getting unsolicited offers these days. It might be exciting. You know, we're seeing private equity groups that are out there shopping for deals. I think a lot of companies that are on the buy side are hunting for some bargains because of COVID. They think they might be able to get a business at an attractive price. There are owners out there that are interested in selling because they don't really want to get locked in again, after the Great Recession and now COVID. They're saying to themselves, I don't want to go through something like this one more time, right? I'm like, let's de-risk financially. So that's driving some of the conversations in the market. But if you can achieve transition readiness, what we always say is the readiness calculus is, if you achieve transition readiness, you have options that you didn't have before. if you have options that you didn't have before, the more options you have, the higher probability of success. Options give, just deliver a higher probability right into your lap. So do the things that create options for you, not just higher value, but options for transfer. And I think your chances of winning that conversation, that battle, that process are much, much higher as a result.
No, I agree. And I think it's like anything else, the better prepared you are, the better results that a person would expect. I want to thank you so much for taking some time with me today and trying to help the business owners who are out there, a whole lot of them, from between baby boom generation, those, like you said, with COVID, or, you know, just getting at a point where they want to move into that next step for their life. So I truly appreciate you taking the time. Sean mentioned how you can reach out to him via his website. Obviously, you want to reach out to us. We'll be happy to forward his information on to you as well. And at the end of the podcast, we'll provide you that information. So again, Sean, thank you so much for taking a little bit of time out of your day. And I truly appreciate it.
You bet. My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to today's show. Remember to subscribe and give us your feedback, and to stay safe, healthy, and also to save and invest in yourself, your future, your family, your health, and your time, and to try to serve others, and you will live a truly rich life.